Welcome to the Urban Lab with Sam Chandon, the podcast on cities and the built environment, featuring leaders in industry, research, and policymaking.
With a majority of the world's population remaining in place, there are vastly fewer cars on the road and planes overhead. All manner of industries and household activities that rely on fossil fuels have seen declines of some degree. In cities such as New Delhi and Mumbai, images of the clearest skies in decades reflect that fossil fuel consumption has plummeted. The resulting decline in oil prices has far-reaching implications, both good and bad, for the global economy, for oil-producing nations, and for cities. With me to discuss the outlook for oil, I'm joined by Dr. Caroline Kassane, Academic Director and Professor at the Center for Global Affairs at the NYU School of Professional Studies and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Dr. Kassane, thanks for joining me. So crude oil prices have fallen from over $50 a barrel in February to less than $10 for much of last week. Is this wholly a collapse in demand related to the pandemic and the curtailment of economic activity, or are there other factors?
For the most part, it is, the collapse in oil prices is linked to the coronavirus. So as you pointed out, in February, we're looking at about $50 a barrel oil. But if you go back even 1 month, in the month of January, you know, Brent crude was trading at $70 a barrel. And, you know, by March, the price had gone from, as I said, you know, 70 in January to the 40s to the 30s. And, you know, now, as you pointed out, we're looking at Brent, which is kind of the European benchmark, which is trading in the mid-20s, and to the U.S. benchmark, West Texas Intermediate, which is trading in the teens, and not in the high teens, in the low teens. Probably many people read in terms of the headline news Tuesday was that WTI traded negatively.
What exactly does that mean when West Texas Intermediate trades at a negative price? How does that happen?
For many analysts, it was mind-boggling. They had never experienced anything like that in their history, either as a trader or as an analyst of oil markets. And it was kind of a unique moment. It's, you know, this was the May contract, which is a future contract that was coming up for expiration. So May 20th was the last day to kind of get rid of your contracts or to move them forward. And basically there was no place for delivery. There was no place for the people who held the contract to anyone. No one was willing to take it off their hands. So they ended up having to pay people to take the contract. By the morning of the 21st, you know, you had seen WTI go back into positive territory, but there is concern, for example, that the June contract will follow a similar path as the May contract. And again, it was unprecedented, and it exposed this issue of, you know, an oversupplied market and not enough storage.
So is this a very practical issue that we were facing, you know, just last week, where there was simply not enough place for the barrels of oil that we had on hand?
That's correct. We've never had so much supply and such a sharp decrease in demand. So if you go back even to the end of December, again, before the pandemic really took hold in China, the world was consuming approximately 100 million barrels a day. And by March into April, that number was 70 million barrels a day. So we lost 30 million barrels a day of demand.
What is happening in terms of supply and production around the world? Has OPEC come to some kind of agreement that will limit supplies for the foreseeable future? Do we have individual countries that are hesitating to actually cut back?
Sam, that's a great question. So again, in April, you know, the OPEC Plus group, you know, kind of with the two leads, Russia and Saudi Arabia, came back to the table, you know, after there was a failed agreement or lack of coming to an agreement in March, came to the agreement that they would collectively cut 9.7 million barrels a day starting on May 1st. But again, the market didn't really respond very positively, partially because it's still an insufficient cut given the complete collapse in demand. Again, if you're looking at 30 million barrels a day lost in demand, and you're taking 9.7, there's still an excess of 20 million barrels a day.
Some countries that are major oil exporters have, you know, reasonably well-diversified economies. Others are completely dependent upon the revenues generated by their oil exports to fund a whole range of economic activities, social service programs. What does all of this mean for, you know, their economies? Importantly, in some cases, what does it also mean for political stability?
Another fantastic question. I think this is the question that keeps me awake at night, because I fear that countries that were already fragile do not have diversified economies, that there was already, we were seeing signs of political instability in countries like Iraq and Algeria and in Iran, that this price collapse is, you know, going to do very significant harm. Countries like Nigeria and Angola are very vulnerable right now. A country that was already on a very thin lifeline, that of Venezuela, is, you know, it's very hard for analysts to sort of see what survival looks like. So I do think we'll have a deepening of political instability in countries that that have not prepared for what, you know, people talk about as the rainy day. They don't have funds set up. They don't have, they're already heavily in debt. The IMF has giving a little bit more leeway to countries that are, you know, deeply in debt. But at the same time, you know, without those revenues coming in from the sale of one of their most significant commodities and export items, you know, that being oil or in some cases gas, it's, you know, it's very hard to sort of imagine how they successfully come out of it, because we're not just looking at, you know, a period of surviving the next month, but potentially 6 months, a year, even 18 months in order to get back to where we were in terms of, you know, demand.
And in terms of that time frame, you know, as an economist, I'm keenly aware of just how much uncertainty there is in our projections. Is it fair to say that that will translate into a degree of uncertainty around the outlook for energy markets and oil prices as well?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the big questions, or one of the big sort of conundrums when we sort of look at that question, is the fact that we have a lot of oil in storage. So storage around the world is about at 75-80%. And what is left in terms of, much of that has been leased or is owned. So we're looking at some point in 2021 where we may see a recovery back to kind of end of 2019 prices.
And so for U.S. consumers, where we might observe this most tangibly is in the extent to which it will translate into lower gas prices at the pump. But for many countries, this has a very real impact on their national accounts. You mentioned a couple of the countries that are major oil exporters. Are there some that are better positioned to withstand and to weather their way through a protracted period of low prices, and others where we're talking about the potential for a humanitarian crisis?
Yes, all of the above. I mean, countries such as Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, you know, even Russia, they have funds, right, that they can tap into. They also can have get access to sort of debt markets, where puts them in a better position. You know, I would say, again, Saudi Arabia looks to be kind of well positioned. Even Russia is well positioned. I mean, one of the things that, you know, the finance minister said in, even in March, said that, you know, Russia could take a period of, you know, 3 to 5 years of $25 a barrel oil. I don't think Russia really wants to test that statement, but that said, they do have reserves in the, you know, any $300 to $400 billion in some cases. Saudi, Kuwait, Oman, these are countries that are better prepared. Yeah, and then other countries, I think, you know, you are going to start to see, you know, a lot of, I think, some horrific, we already see that. I mean, Venezuela is a humanitarian crisis.
On the other side of this, where you have countries like India that are a different stage of development as compared to China, does lower energy prices have an upside in a case like that?
Oh, absolutely. Like for countries that are dependent on oil imports, this just these last 2 months, you know, have been an opportunity. The problem is that, you know, India, again, as we talked about earlier, is on lockdown through the 1st of May. So their own demand is down quite significantly. Again, that issue kind of goes back to storage. So, you know, India is buying more oil than it's currently using, and it's putting that into reserves that it can tap into in the future. But again, there's kind of limited space that they have to actually purchase that supply that they can use in the future.
You know, a closing question for you. A lot of our listeners are focused on issues related to cities, the urban environment, and sustainability. You know, is there a chance here that, you know, very low fossil fuel prices actually has the effect of slowing, you know, our move away from the use of fossil fuels, that we see our sustainability efforts actually losing some of their momentum because it is simply so cheap to buy gas?
Yeah, no, and I think a lot of people, that's their fear. People who, you know, work in the, you know, the renewable energy space, they do fear that, you know, low oil and gas prices, you know, drive more use of those fossil fuels. I think it depends. Part of it in, you know, for example, if you look at Europe as a case, like Europe has recommitted to its Green New Deal and recommitted to making sure that parts of its sort of stimulus funds go into the energy transition and the move away from fossil fuels to cleaner sources of energy. But again, I think there are some harsh realities that are going to confront, you know, larger economies, larger country economies, as well as the states here in the United States, and how they prioritize, you know, where budget revenues go.
Thanks for listening to the Urban Lab. For more information about the program and our host, Sam Chandon, please visit samchandon.com/urbanlab.